right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really glad to be here today and really glad to be bringing you Bruce Cummings. And this is going to be a two-part interview that will take up most of the show. The reason I'm re-airing this interview now should be obvious. As RevCom.us recently wrote, in a wanton and extremely dangerous act of gangster imperialist aggression, Trump canceled the U.S.'s planned June 12th summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He uttered a few empty words about peace, prosperity, and humanity, and then threatened North Korea with a nuclear war. You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used. And then he ominously warned the North Koreans, that the U.S. military was the most powerful in the world and ready, and in his words, should foolish or reckless acts be taken by North Korea. The U.S. message to North Korea, capitulate or else. This greatly heightens the real and present danger of a war with North Korea, a war which could kill an estimated 300,000 people in the first few days if it stayed non-nuclear, 1 million people the first day if it went nuclear, and many, many more if it escalated beyond the Korean Peninsula. Such a war would be a terrible crime, a totally unjust and totally unnecessary war of empire that could literally put the future existence of all of humanity at risk. That was the beginning of the article, Trump-Pence Regime's Gangster Moves and Threats in Korea Are an Urgent Danger to Humanity. All these gangster moves are based on a mountain of lies that North Korea is the aggressor, that it never listens to reason. People who should know better have praised Trump for agreeing to talk with North Korea in the first place, forgetting what they knew a year ago, that this whole crisis was provoked solely by the U.S. And although the Trump-Pence regime seems to be sending slightly different signals, the seeming chaos, internal conflict, and sense of high-stakes gambling on the part of the U.S. in particular all make the situation more, not less, dangerous for people. All these gangster moves are based on a mountain of lies that North Korea is the aggressor, that it never listens to reason. People who should know better have praised Trump for agreeing to talk with North Korea in the first place, forgetting what they knew a year ago, that this whole crisis was provoked solely by the U.S., and although the Trump-Pence regime seems to be sending slightly different signals, the seeming chaos, internal conflict, and sense of high-stakes gambling on the part of the U.S. in particular all make the situation more, not less, dangerous. People need to learn the truth and be part of active opposition to the logic of the U.S. position and the momentum and direction of its continued threats. In the middle of the show, I'm going to be playing a short clip from a talk by Bob Avakian that we've heard a few times on this show. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, this is about American exceptionalism, and I think it's an appropriate antidote for the sickening, unquestioning patriotism that has been pumped out all around this Memorial Day. It's called Free Yourself from the Great Tautological Fallacy, the GTF, which he explains in the excerpt. Part one of Bruce Cummings was recorded around the time of a critical moment in U.S. threats against North Korea that happened last Memorial Day. Bruce Cummings
is a person who has spent his life studying Korea, and in particular North Korea, and what's going on between North Korea and the rest of the world. We're talking with Bruce on a real history of U.S. relations with North Korea, which has been a history of nonstop U.S. aggression. Bruce is the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Service Professor in History at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil and The Truth About North Korea and Syria. So let's just jump into it. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Back in late March, you wrote a piece titled, This is What's Really Behind North Korea's Nuclear Provocations. And you opened it up with a description of Trump having dinner with the Japanese prime minister, and that the dinner was disrupted by news that North Korea had fired off a new solid-fuel intermediate-range ballistic missile. And it was aimed towards Japan. Now, this was a huge thing in the news everywhere. There was a message in the missile that you pointed to. Let's talk about that.
Well, it was a very pointed message because Prime Minister Abe, having dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Trump, is the grandson of one of the most powerful Japanese leaders and politicians in the mid-20th century, Kishi Nobusuke. And in the 1930s, he was manufacturing munitions in the puppet state of Manchukuo, northeast China, or Manchuria, as we knew it at the time. And Kim Il-sung, who is, of course, the grandfather of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, was fighting really for a decade against the Japanese in Manchuria. So that history, which is still very alive for both the Japanese and the North Koreans, is nonetheless hardly known at all in this country. The U.S. declared Mr. Kishi to be a Class A war criminal during our occupation of Japan after the war. He spent time in jail. But when he got out, the U.S. supported him to the hilt. He was one of the founders of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is the major party in Japan, a country that's had a kind of one-party rule going back to 1955 when the LDP was founded, I might add, with a lot of CIA money. And then Kishi was prime minister in the late 50s twice. So suddenly he goes from American enemy in World War II to big American friend. And the current prime minister, Abe, really reveres his grandfather. So the North Koreans made a very pointed comment just by the timing of this particular missile. But they did it again on Memorial Day. Nobody in this country ever points it out. I mean, they blew off an atomic bomb on Memorial Day during President Obama's first few months in office. And they launched a missile toward Japan on Memorial Day, the one we just had. So the North Koreans must have at least some aggravation that nobody seems to get their messages.
When it comes to nukes and nuclear weapons and the situation in North Korea versus South Korea, and of course, standing in there, and really the principal character in a lot of this is the U.S. and what they've actually been orchestrating for decades now, many decades. And one of the things that you say in your part of the book, Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, you argue that the U.S., in fact, today, when it's talking about all this stuff around the North Koreans are terrorizing people, there's news that they've just fired off another missile down towards Japan and all this stuff, and it's really making it seem like they're just frothing at the mouth and raring to go. You make a point in your book that I thought was important for people to understand, and it's something that never does ever come out, which is that the United States terrorized North Korea with nuclear weapons during and after the Korean War, and was the only power to introduce nuclear weapons to Korean soil. So there's a lot that's just unknown by people, even as they sit there and are fed all this stuff about how the North Koreans are crazy and they're playing with nukes. And here you have the U.S. as being actually the progenitor of all this.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where most people, including a lot of liberals, accepted the fact that Saddam Hussein was a vicious dictator who had WMDs. And there was no real background given to, for example, our support of Saddam Hussein in the 1980s in the war with Iran. Then we have a war, and the war goes very badly. It's still a complete catastrophe. And all this history comes out. And if we were to go to war with North Korea, which has seemed closer under the Trump administration than it has been in some time, all of this would come out about the U.S. running an operation called Hudson Harbor in 1951, where B-29s dropped dummy atomic bombs on North Korea to see whether they might be useful against troop concentrations in cities. President Eisenhower, toward the end of the war in May 1953, tested one of the largest atomic bombs ever tested and also shot the first atomic cannon. And this was all put on front page of newspapers and was intended to bring an end to the war and intimidate North Korea and China. And then, as you said, in 1958, we installed hundreds of nuclear weapons, battlefield tactical weapons, and short-range warheads on missiles into South Korea. So we're the first one to introduce nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula and kept them there until 1991, when they were withdrawn on a world scale because the Pentagon felt that precision-guided high explosives, but non-nuclear weapons, would cause fewer problems. You wouldn't have radiation and collateral damage from nuclear weapons. So we drew them back. But you can leave it to Donald Trump to tell you what the North Koreans still face, for example, a Trident submarine, sometimes called Armageddon in one sausage tube. He mentioned that two of our nuclear submarines, were off of North Korea last week. This is, of course, classified information. He's not supposed to say that. He doesn't know that, but the fact is that one of our nuclear submarines, or all of them, could run right up to the North Korean coast and obliterate North Korea in a matter of hours. Colin Powell, back in 1995, which should give your listeners an idea of how long this problem has been going on. It's really 25 years we've been dealing with the North Korean nuclear problem. Colin Powell said if they ever used a nuclear weapon in anger, the U.S. would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. I just want to say one more thing about that. If you imagine North Korea as the green team against the blue team rather than the evil Kim Jong-un with his crazy haircut against the always perfect United States, you can see what they're up against. It's a small country, and the largest power in the world is constantly threatening it with nuclear annihilation. President Obama did this, too. He routinely sent nuclear-capable B-1 and B-2 bombers over South Korea for exercises. So it's a very dangerous situation, and I think it's incumbent upon Americans to put themselves in the shoes of the North Koreans and look at the world that they face, quite apart from all of our media stereotypes about how crazy they are and how dangerous they are.
Which brings us right to this, too, because when you want to talk about crazy and dangerous, you say that the North Korea, would not have had nukes if the U.S. had actually kept its word in the past.
People who follow this situation closely and high officials in the Clinton administration, like Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Wendy Sherman, her very close aide on North Korea, have written about this. Bill Clinton nearly struck North Korea with a preemptive attack against their nuclear facility in June 1994. It was only later that people realized or came to understand how close we were to a war with North Korea at that time. But Jimmy Carter intervened. When he heard about all of this, he flew to Pyongyang and talked directly with Kim Il-sung and got a freeze on all of North Korea's plutonium. It's very important to underline that that freeze was completely monitored and checked for 8 years, 24/7. You had UN inspectors on the grounds, closed circuit cameras watching it at all times. The reactors were sealed. And of course, we know with our intelligence when a reactor starts up. So there's no question the North Koreans didn't have an ounce of plutonium from 1994 to 2002. However, George Bush had already put North Korea in his axis of evil in 2002, and then in September, he announced his preemptive doctrine, which the euphemism was anticipatory self-defense, and North Korea, along with Iran and especially Iraq, were listed as the countries for which this policy was developed. He then went ahead, of course, to invade Iraq in March of 2003, which was really a preventive war rather than anticipatory self-defense. I mean, we don't need to get into this, but Saddam Hussein was actually writing a novel at the time and trying to do everything he could not to provoke the U.S. After that happened, North Korea just said as openly and loudly as it could, Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons. If he had them, he wouldn't have been overthrown. That's not going to happen to us. And they systematically began building. They got back their plutonium, kicked out the inspectors, and systematically began building atomic weapons and tested the first one just 3 years later in 2006. I don't think it's a partisan judgment, but a factual statement to say that George W. Bush has two enormous catastrophes on his hands. One is the invasion of Iraq, which basically wrecked the Middle East since 2003. And second, he is the primary person responsible for North Korea getting nuclear weapons. And I think many experts believe that. Madeleine Albright has written about that. But it doesn't get out in the media at all, in part because so many of our people want to say, well, it's six of one, half dozen of the other, or not to sound partisan.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author. And he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Bruce, let me ask you this. As we're talking about this, basically it seems to be a fact that the U.S. has not paid any attention at all to what the North Koreans have actually done in relation to all the various agreements around missiles and nukes. It seems like they just keep steamrolling in a way to push in a certain direction. They're just going to go after North Korea to take it out.
Well, that is generally true of more recent administrations, but the Clinton administration, after toying with the idea of attacking North Korea, as I said, froze their nuclear facility for 8 years, and then from 1998 to 2000, William Perry, Clinton's former defense secretary, became a kind of roving ambassador for North Korea, and along with South Korea, whose president, Kim Dae-jung, had started an engagement policy with North Korea. For 2 years, you had talks on a whole host of subjects, ending the Korean War, getting rid of their plutonium once and for all, and basically buying out their medium and long-range missiles indirectly. This was a terribly important agreement that was signed, in effect, in October 2000 when a very high North Korean general, Cho Myung-nok, who was responsible for their conglomerate that builds their missiles, came to the White House, met with Bill Clinton, Cho having his full military regalia on, and they signed an agreement saying neither country would have hostile intentions toward the other. And if Clinton would go to Pyongyang to meet with then-leader Kim Jong-il, North Korea would mothball its missiles and enter the missile technology control regime, which would limit their missiles to 300 kilometers. Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at the time, then went to North Korea in late October, met with Kim Jong-il to work on this deal. But then, of course, we had the 2000 election, and for 6 weeks we didn't know who was going to be president. And when the Supreme Court gave it to George Bush, his people said they didn't like that agreement. You can just read Madam Albright's memoirs to see how flabbergasted she was by that, because North Korea would not have the missiles that they keep blowing off if we had followed through on that agreement. I mean, the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, really has a lot to answer for, not only in allowing North Korea to get hold of its plutonium again, but in allowing this missile deal to drop between the stools. Now, Obama was better in the sense that he did try to initiate talks with North Korea in 2012, but he also put North Korea kind of on the back burner among the country's pariah states, let's say, that he wanted to open relations with, Cuba, Burma, Iran, and even Laos. And he never got around to North Korea. And as I said before, he also frequently lofted these B-1 bombers over the South just to let the North Koreans know who's boss.
One of the things, though, that you talk about, too, in this number of articles, where you talk about most recently the use of agreements, et cetera, have been kicked to the curb, that there's an assumption that no one has been able to rein in the nuts in North Korea and their nuke program, and it's time to fight or topple. Let's talk about that.
People routinely say North Korea has always cheated and never has kept to its agreements, and I don't know where they're coming from because it's simply not true. In addition to the plutonium agreement, the freeze, and the missile deal, North Korea in 2000 also opened relations with many of our allies, so they have diplomatic relations with Canada and Great Britain, France, Germany, Italy. We're one of the last countries not to have relations with North Korea, still trying to isolate it. But the fact is, North Korea was really reaching out, and then they faced a wall of hostility from Bush. It is true that if we continue to intimidate North Korea with nuclear weapons and bring them into the theater by submarines and air power, anybody in North Korea would get a deterrent. In that sense, the critics of North Korea are right that North Korea, when it felt intimidated over many, many years, eventually developed nuclear weapons. It might have happened anyway, but the fact is we did have agreements with them that kept them from moving to nuclear weapons. Finally, I would say, in response to your question, that the discourse about North Korea under Trump has just been absurd, in that Trump, as I said, talked about our nuclear submarines off the coast. He has threatened North Korea. He's also said he'd like to talk to Kim Jong-un over a hamburger. That might be the better way to go. But he's so erratic, and the one thing that the North Koreans notice is the submarines, the two aircraft carrier task forces that are in Northeast Asian waters right now. What Trump has done privately or secretly, and what the Pentagon has done, is just jam a bunch of hardware up against North Korea. Meanwhile, our press, and that includes not Fox News, but CNN and MSNBC, are constantly running scare stories about North Korea. I saw on CNN that Anna Navarro, one of their frequent commentators, even referred to Kim by his first name, saying little boy Un is a maniac. She probably thought that was his last name, but that's the level of discourse that we've had about North Korea under Trump.
And related to that, you've pointed out that North Korea is the only country in the world to have been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going all the way back to the 50s. When you're looking at this, all these other places that have developed some form of nuclear weaponry or are trying to get it, or and then the main focus is on North Korea. Why?
That generalization wouldn't have held up if we looked at China in the 50s and early 60s before they got nuclear weapons. We were doing the same thing to China, intimidating them, blackmailing them, that we did to North Korea, and nearly got into a war over some tiny islands in 1958 with China. You might also say that Iran has been similarly intimidated, but we have not been close to war with Iran, nor have we fought a war with Iran. But with North Korea, we fought a bloody war for 3 years. We've had 72 years of conflict with them going back to the initial American occupation of Southern Korea in 1945. And China, once it got its own nuclear weapons, of course, we weren't in a position to do much about that. It creates a kind of Mexican standoff for nuclear deterrence. But with North Korea, we really have just decades of threatening this small country with nuclear weapons, and why should we be surprised when they finally want to get a deterrent of their own?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author, and he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Related to that, you have something like Leon Panetta's statement that we have been within an inch of war with the North Koreans for many months. And so then he advocated dropping these dummy bombs. This seems to be a constant edge of the North Koreans are actually living on the edge of what could be massive incineration and unbelievable havoc being wreaked on the Korean people.
If there were a new war in Korea, it would extend to Japan and all of our military bases in the region, including Guam, where we have huge installations and hundreds of bases in Japan and South Korea with almost 80,000 troops on the ground in Japan and South Korea, American troops. They would all be targeted by the North Koreans, and the North Koreans wouldn't win this war, but they would absolutely devastate the region. And that's why there is no military solution to the problems in Korea. There never has been, as we learned in the Korean War when it ended in a stalemate. Leon Panetta's statement is particularly worrisome because it was during the Obama administration. He told CNN in 2011, just as you said, we'd been within an inch of war with North Korea for months on end. And this went back to 2010 when there were skirmishes in what Koreans call the West Sea and everybody else calls the Yellow Sea on the western midriff of the Korean Peninsula. There are clashes there all the time, particularly in May and June when the crabbing season begins and North and South Korean fishing boats get into conflict with each other. There's also a northern limit line in the sea that the U.S. and South Korea recognize, but North Korea has never recognized it. And Henry Kissinger, when he was Secretary of State, said it was totally illegal under international law. So you don't have a demilitarized zone or a line that everybody recognizes. Instead, you have a kind of free-for-all there. And in 2010, it escalated to the point where the North Koreans took out a South Korean ship, a naval ship, and killed more than 30 of their sailors. And that ratcheted up the tension a great deal, and it's what led in 2011 to Panetta's statement. But it's absolutely ridiculous to imagine a general war in the region breaking out because of crabbing ground conflicts and a situation in the sea there that should long ago have been resolved. Getting a North Korean agreement to where their boats can go and where South Korean boats can go.
You've also made a point, and I think this is really important, that there's a whole different perception of the problem, the source of danger in relation to nukes in Korea. And it's sort of that, you know, there's an epistemology that sort of is always bad no matter when it's used, which is based on everybody knows, you know, and that is a very dangerous thing in relation to this. In reality, there's a long history, as you've been saying, to nuclear threats against North Korea itself. In fact, the U.S. has recently installed the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. Let's talk about those two things.
Well, that was one of the more cynical ploys on the part of the United States in recent years. This terminal high altitude area defense system was jammed into South Korea while the current president, at the time President Park Geun-hye, was being impeached, and before the election that was held earlier this month, which brought a progressive to power. And the U.S. fears that Moon Jae-in, the new president, will be an engager of North Korea, like his mentor, Nomu-hyun, who was president from 2002 to 2007. And so they wanted to get that system in and installed before the new president came into office. And he just complained last week that four launchers were brought in without his permission or without his office being notified about that. In other words, we are continuing to add to the system even after he's president without telling him. It's just an outrageous situation in our relationship with South Korea. We hardly ever have problems with the ruling party that goes back to the dictators, but we always have problems with liberals and progressives who want to try a different approach toward North Korea. The only time that has not been true is when Bill Clinton and William Perry brought American policy around to engagement for 2 years, 1998 to 2000. That's the only time we've had direct talks with the North Koreans that have really yielded so much. But I would expect that President Trump is not going to like President Moon very well, and you'll see a lot of tension in their relationship, just as there was between George W. Bush and Nomu Hyun in the early 2000s. I want to say one more thing about THAAD system. It's really designed not to knock down North Korean missiles. North Korea has short and medium range missiles that it can launch by the dozens, and there's no way this THAAD system can knock them down. It's really there to monitor North Korean long range missiles and Chinese missile tests and long range missiles, and the Chinese have complained mightily about this. I think the THAAD system's installation in South Korea was primarily political, in that it was trying to get it in there before a progressive president was elected, and to do what the U.S. has been trying to do for many, many years, which is to weld South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. together in an alignment or an alliance to contain China. It doesn't really have much to do at all with the so-called North Korean threat, but it has a lot to do with off China and, you know, making sure the system's in there before a president comes to power who might not like it.
One more question, Bruce. Just how dangerous is this situation, both in terms of war and even the impact of war on human survival?
Well, I'm in touch with 30 or 40 people who work on North Korea, former government officials, scholars. Somehow North Korea has become a big deal. We have 15 or 20 websites dealing with it now. We never had 10 or 15 years ago. But in the last couple of months, I've seen time and again very well-informed experts worrying about the U.S. and North Korea coming to blows. It could come from an incident that ratchets up into a war, or it could come from a preemptive attack. And there was a great deal of talk back in March and April about Trump people favoring a preemptive attack on North Korea on its missiles. You can't really attack their nuclear facilities preemptively, or you'll lose a hell of a lot of radiation around the region. There was almost a consensus inside the Beltway in the fall and winter that if North Korea keeps moving toward an ability to hit the United States with a long-range missile and a nuclear weapon, we just have to think about preempting that. And it's very, very dangerous because along the DMZ there have been cycles of preemption and counter-preemption both happening and envisioned by the respective militaries, North and South Korea and the U.S., going back decades, going back to the Korean War. So to add the threat of a preemptive attack on North Korea's missiles is just to really come close to bringing forth the general war in the region that we talked about.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. And we've been talking about what the hell the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea, and what danger does it pose for the Korean people and for humanity as a whole. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. It's hard to stop that one, but we got to roll along. That's At the Drive-In with Governed by Contagion. Okay, that's actually absolutely appropriate title to be playing today. All right. Now let's hear that piece from Bob Avakian, the most radical revolutionary on the planet and the architect of a whole new framework of human emancipation, the new synthesis of communism, which is also popularly referred to as the new communism. Now he's talking about the great tautological fallacy, the GTF. From the Trump-Pence regime must go, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America, a better world is possible. And if you want to hear that entire speech and the Q&A session, you can go to revcom.us and find it there.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism. The disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF, the great tautological fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the great tautological fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world, and therefore whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat.
Now, as I said earlier, that was Bob Avakian from the talk "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And as I also said earlier, the entire film and the whole Q&A session is available at revcom.us, and you can find the link on my Facebook page. Now let's have a little bit more music, and then we'll hear part two of my interview with Bruce Cummings. All right, that was Eve of Destruction by Public Enemy. That's right, Public Enemy doing a cover of Eve of Destruction. And now you know that the situation is serious. Now we're going to hear part two of my interview with Bruce Cummings. I want to remind listeners that this was recorded about 9 months ago. It's an indication of how quickly things are moving under the Trump-Pence fascist regime, that the things that were dangerous 9 months ago are even more dangerous now. To take just one thing, Trump has assembled his war cabinet. Rex Tillerson is out, and the Christian fascist Mike Pompeo is now Secretary of State. John Bolton, a lying America First fascist warmonger who has been arguing for preemptive war against North Korea for a long time now, is now Trump's national security advisor. Pompeo's old job as head of the CIA is filled by a proven torturer, Gina Haspel, installed with the help of the Democrats in Congress. So let's hear Bruce Cummings, the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Chicago, the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria.
Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, good, man. So listen, anyone listening to the news today, right, they learn that North Korea has fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile, they've tested a nuclear missile, the missile that they fired passed over northern Japan, and it's all and they say that they're ratcheting up the threat of war that would likely result in tens of thousands of deaths just in a few hours. That's what's actually happening, is that that is objectively being ratcheted up, I think. And when you look at everything that's going out there now, and even more recently, where you see Secretary of Defense James Mattis recently stating that any threat to the U.S. or its territories will be met with a massive military response that is both effective and overwhelming. And then there is Trump, and need we say more? So what do you make of this, Bruce? What's going on here?
Well, there never has been an administration that has threatened an attack on North Korea so frequently and with such hyperbole, never before Trump. Trump himself has no experience whatsoever in foreign affairs. He knows nothing about Korea. I imagine he would have had trouble finding North Korea on a map a couple of years ago. So it's just doubly and triply dangerous because he has three advisors, all military men, former generals, his chief of staff, Kelly, his national security advisor, McMaster, and Mad Dog Mattis, who Trump particularly seems to favor. And so you have a naive president surrounded by military people and hardly anyone, and I would say including Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who has any experience with diplomacy. And yet American diplomacy toward North Korea has achieved great goals in spite of what I think Trump just said yesterday, that we've talked for 25 years and have gotten nowhere. President Clinton and his Secretary of Defense, later Special Ambassador for North Korea, William Perry, not only froze all of North Korea's fissile material, at that time plutonium, for 8 years, but in 2000, they had a deal to indirectly buy out North Korea's medium and long-range missiles. A North Korean general came to meet Clinton in the White House. They signed a statement saying neither country would have hostile intent toward the other. Madeleine Albright then went to Pyongyang to meet the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il 2 weeks later. She was working out an arrangement for President Clinton to visit Pyongyang in December 2000. And if he had done that, Kim Jong-il was willing to put North Korea inside the missile technology control regime. This is something that would limit their missiles to a 300-kilometer range. South Korea is also part of the MTCR. I say this in some detail because the discourse, and now it's a bipartisan discourse, Democrats and Republicans, is that North Korea cheats all the time. It's a terrible threat, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would encourage your listeners to just go to the New York Times website and look at Michael Gordon's long article on this missile deal, March 6, 2001, or read William Perry's memoir that came out a couple of years ago. North Korea was fully within an American-sanctioned regime that would have kept its plutonium frozen and would have eliminated its missile threat. And along comes George W. Bush. Obviously, the worst thing he did was invade Iraq, which is a continuing, unfolding catastrophe. But the second worst thing he did is to kick over these agreements with North Korea. He refused to pursue the missile agreement. And then, as part of his preemptive doctrine, he targeted North Korea along with Iraq and Iran, and then sent an emissary to Pyongyang in October 2002. To accuse them of having a second nuclear program, this time with enriched uranium, whereupon the North Koreans kicked the emissary out and kicked out the inspectors from the UN that had been there 8 years, got back all their plutonium, and busted off their first atomic bomb in 2006. So Bush really is responsible for two catastrophic failures, one with Iraq and the other with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because something, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot since this has all come up and since the last time we spoke, and then just reading a lot of the coverage of this, Trump actually is accusing North Korea, and as you're pointing to, he's accusing North Korea of contempt for their neighbors and violating minimum standards of acceptable international behavior, that North Korea is threatening and destabilizing the region. And it does say something when you think about it, what North Korea has said, and I don't think that North Korea is any bastion or beacon of hope in the world, but actually in what's happening here is that what they're doing to them, they're actually saying that they're doing the stuff where they're saying they're unstable, and they're trying to, you know, get out and destroy and take over all of Korea, and they're threatening nuclear war on everyone. But actually, even the recent missile tests and the ways that they've developed things have been more in response to what people aren't paying attention or what people aren't talking about a whole lot, is there's major war games that were going on there, war games that were actually directed primarily at making a point to North Korea. Is that true?
Well, the U.S. has pursued war games going back into the Bush administration in Korea that target the leadership for decapitation attacks. They also practice landing tens of thousands of Marines behind North Korean lines in a preemptive attack to march on Pyongyang and replace the leadership. And, of course, the U.S. has blackmailed North Korea going back now really almost 70 years to 1950 with nuclear weapons. We had nuclear weapons stationed in South Korea from 1958 to 1991. And every time North Korea tests a missile or a bomb, the president, and that would include Trump or Obama or Bush, will send B-2 nuclear-capable bombers over South Korea. Obama did some dummy atomic bomb drops on South Korean islands during his presidency. So, I mean, I have to say that the history that I just went through from the 1990s is generally not known, very important to bring out. But what the media and American officials and spokespeople and all of that never examine is the history of American nuclear intimidation of North Korea. If you just assume, I mean, as you said, North Korea is no beacon of hope for the world. But if you say this is country X colored blue instead of red, and just look at the world from their standpoint, they've been under this threat now for more than 50 years. In the early 60s, Kim Il-sung openly said, "We have no defense against nuclear weapons except to build underground." And so they've created some 15,000 underground subterranean facilities related to national security. Almost their entire military is underground. You know, and they are able now with their engineers to dig very deep so that even a direct nuclear hit would not take out the leadership. You may remember that was how the Iraq war started, with shock and awe, taking out a bunker where Saddam Hussein was supposed to be hiding. It turned out he wasn't there, of course. But at any rate, looking at the world from North Korea's standpoint, you almost would become paranoid and defensive and desperate for your own security. If I could say another thing about the region, North Korea's medium-range missile fired over Japan was unquestionably a provocative act. They've never fired a medium-range missile over Japan, but it went over it about 350 miles up. They also launched a rocket trying to put up a satellite in 1998, and the papers after that said the rocket was launched over Japan. I mean, it entered the stratosphere over Japan. There are two things to say about this. Number one, what other direction are they going to fire it, over China or Russia? Number two, it always is optimal to launch missiles to the east to take advantage of the Earth's rotation. This is just rocket science 101 for people who know about launching rockets. But it's never mentioned in our media that North Korea doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of directions in which to shoot these things, and it's to their advantage to shoot them to the east.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago. He's a history professor at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books on the Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and many others, actually. We're talking about what's going on with North Korea and what the U.S. is doing in relation to that. I was just thinking when you were talking, I was thinking about something that I read in what you wrote and then some other places. You know, this whole point about all the various manifestations of U.S. military power. Generally, what they aim at doing is keeping North Korea in a state, a constant state of siege and terror. And that goes all the way back, to a certain extent, it goes all the way back to the what happened after the Korean War and what happened in those decades, you know, between the Korean War and now, where basically North Korea might not have even had nukes at all if the U.S. had kept its word, instead of being actually focusing on what they have done, and which is really what they intended, was to basically keep North Korea under their heel.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. very consciously violated the armistice of 1953. The armistice agreement was, it prohibited upgrading of weapons within Korea. And of course, both sides immediately started upgrading their weapons after the war ended in 1953. But in top secret documentation from the Eisenhower administration, you see Secretary of State Dulles acknowledging that both sides, or all sides, including South Korea, the Chinese, North Korea, and the U.S., have been upgrading their weaponry. But introducing nuclear weapons violates the armistice. And Dulles was very much a legalist, and he, for a time, he opposed putting nuclear weapons into Korea. But then Admiral Radford, a real hawk back in the 1950s, argued that nuclear weapons were important and we could go ahead and break the armistice. Who's going to try and enforce it or do anything to us about it? And so the U.S. went ahead and violated the armistice. Now, when you look at contemporary North Korean rhetoric, they hit on two points over and over again. Their tests of bombs and nukes will end or stop when A, the U.S. is not hostile to North Korea, and B, when the U.S. stops running these war games. Now, Nikki Haley said this week that it's insulting to imagine trading off our war games for their nukes and missiles. But that's exactly what Bill Clinton did in 1994. The U.S. had been running the largest war games in the world called Team Spirit from 1976 until the early 1990s. More than 200,000 troops, Korean and American, sometimes participated in these war games. The North Koreans demanded that they stop as part of the deal to freeze their reactor in 1994, their plutonium reactor. And the U.S. agreed to that. Then the Bush administration, as part of its preemptive doctrine, started war games up again. They're not as large as Team Spirit, but my point is it's entirely within the history of American diplomacy toward North Korea to make that trade-off of halting our war games in return for them stopping their testing. This is what China and Russia have called a freeze-freeze agreement. We freeze our war games, they freeze their nukes and missiles. And both of those things hark back to the best diplomacy that the U.S. ever achieved with North Korea, which was the Perry process from 1998 to 2000, freezing the plutonium and getting rid of their missiles. So this idea that North Korea, you know, has no other choice or is just hell-bent on developing a complete nuclear arsenal goes right against the actual history of our diplomacy with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce, one of the things that I kept thinking about here, too, is you make a point in a number of places, and I think it's really important for people to understand that North Korea made clear when they developed nuclear weapons that this was not based on first strike capacity. Ignoring this kind of thing has actually allowed the U.S., and actually lying about it, has allowed the U.S. to actually sort of amp up what they intend to do or the kind of nuclear terrorism that they're practicing against North Korea, right?
Well, North Korea doesn't have either a first strike or a second strike in its strategy, because the first time that they would use a nuclear weapon, we would obliterate them. Colin Powell, more than 20 years ago in 1995, said if the North used a nuclear weapon in anger, we would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. Of course, what most people don't know is we already did that during the Korean War with 3 years of carpet bombing, so that hardly a modern building stood in any of North Korea's cities. And of course, that's something the North Koreans know like the back of their hand and recall all the time. Most of them would have lost parents or grandparents in that bombing, at least one or, you know, a relative. Americans don't know anything about the Korean War, let alone this destruction of North Korea. There's something just vicious, villainous about prominent Americans like Colin Powell, who I like very much, Hillary Clinton, who also referred to demolishing North Korea. It's a bipartisan principle that if North Korea, if we get into a war, no matter how it starts, and North Korea might be about to use a nuclear weapon or uses a nuclear weapon, that we would wipe the face of North Korea clean and turn it into a charcoal briquette. It's really a long history of these terrible threats. I wrote a piece in the London Review of Books last May where I pointed out that even a small, so-called small nuclear war in which maybe 10 weapons were detonated, like the example that scientists use is a quick nuclear war between Pakistan and India, that would likely produce 2 years of nuclear winter and lead to the failure of crops on a world scale and the deaths of starvation of millions of people. Nuclear weapons are terrible weapons of mass destruction, far worse than biological or chemical weapons, and they should be abolished. But particularly the way Trump and his people throw around nuclear threats at North Korea. It's enough to, it's just nauseating.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, one of the things is, and it's pretty heavy, I think, when you think about this, is that the U.S. is actually, what you were saying about the what they did during the Korean War, you know, it, and actually to add to what you said, it's also that they did carry out the murder of over 30% of the population during that war, 3 to 5 million people. And you look at this and you think about one big bone of contention is that they even in all of this, they have never, ever recognized the legitimacy of North Korea as a state. And in fact, you pointed out that it's that North Korea is the only country in the world that has been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going back to the 50s, literally terrorized.
That's right. I mean, the total numbers of dead are not really known from the Korean War. North Korea only had 8 or 9 million people when the war started, and I would estimate about 2 million died. That's one in every four people, which puts North Korea on a par with Poland and Russia as the, you know, the three worst casualty totals of any war in the 20th century, you know, in terms of their populations, their relative populations. North Korea has not been was not recognized when it established itself 69 years ago on September 9th, 1948. We started embargoes against them before the Korean War in 1949 when we slapped embargoes on both Communist China and North Korea. We've embargoed them ever since. It's they themselves, their entire ideology and their nationalism has to do with being recognized, having dignity as a people and a country, not being disrespected, and on that basis, joining with the world community. And because they have never gotten either recognition by the U.S., by the way, I should tell your viewers that almost all of our allies, with the exception of Japan and South Korea, have normalized relations with North Korea years ago. I mean, Canada, Australia, France, Germany, England. We're one of the only countries in the world that doesn't recognize North Korea. But anyway, we could solve this problem with North Korea very quickly and get a freeze on any future nuclear or missile activity by, one, declaring that we are not in a hostile relationship with them, stopping the war games, number two. Number three, recognizing them diplomatically. And all of a sudden, North Korea would be more like Cuba, which we now have an embassy in and which Americans visit. And I mean, what's the worst that has happened since Obama normalized relations with Cuba? More tourists and a boost to the Cuban economy. So it's quite possible to follow those three steps and normalize relations with North Korea, but I sincerely doubt that this administration would even be willing to do one of those things.
Yeah. We have time for one more question, and it's only going to be about 2 minutes, so I'll ask you real quick.
Sure.
Sanctions. Oftentimes people think sanctions might be a lesser way to go at things, but sanctions actually would have an enormous bad impact on North Korea. It'd be collective punishment of all of the people, right?
Well, North Korea, as I said, has been sanctioned since 1949, and the sanctions have just been increased in recent years under both Obama and Trump. The U.S. succeeded in getting China to shut off coal imports from North Korea, which was a major, about $1 billion item in their trade with China. Now people are calling for China to shut off oil, and that would impose great hardship on the North Korean people themselves. But Peter Hayes, who's the best expert on North Korean energy, says that they have about a year's stockpile of oil. So they're not going to be affected for at least a year by shutting off oil. Furthermore, shutting off oil is what we did to Japan in July 1941, and we ended up in a war with Japan the following December. I don't think China is ever going to shut off oil to North Korea just because Trump wants them to. But even if they did, Vladimir Putin is exactly right when he said the North Koreans will eat grass before they'll give up their nuclear deterrent. I found that statement very interesting, and it suggests Putin knows a hell of a lot more about the North than our president does.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thanks.
And we'll look forward to having you back. We're going to follow this
endlessly,
I think. So, all right, Bruce, take care, man.
Bye
now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings from the University of Chicago, and we've been talking about what the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea. And as you heard, it's basically out to get them.
Now, as I said at the beginning of the show, the U.S. gangster moves against North Korea and a bunch of other countries as well are based on a mountain of lies. And I know that many of you who listen to this show want to actually learn the truth and spread the truth. Well, RevCom.us has put together a virtual teach-in on what's going on with Korea. Is the U.S. actually preparing for a war, possibly a nuclear war, with North Korea? What is driving this conflict? What is the history between the U.S. and North Korea? What can be done to protest and prevent such a war? You can find this at revcom.us and, as always, linked to my Facebook page. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank Dr. Bruce Cummings for sharing his knowledge of these events with us. I also want to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer Henry Carson, my production assistant Jeff Pryor, and my engineer Kiana Williams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Awakening from Leon Parker. Talk to you again next week.